But with this 7:30 gathering, we kind of begin the more intentional process of transitioning to leaving the retreat. And so we have a little different event in here than we would normally do. We just, that 7:45 sitting, we sit quietly. And I'm going to talk a little bit to kind of say some words, trying to follow up a little bit on our theme. And and we'll take a little time for some questions and answers in here, if you have any you'd like to have a chance to ask us. And then some announcements that we need to have in order to do the closing of the retreat properly. Cleaning rooms and cleaning the center. And but part of the function of this transition is to start bringing in some more energy, some more kind of other way of being, so we don't just kind of cruise along in silence until 12:15 tomorrow, and then, you know, rush you out the door. You know, it would be kind of a shock, I think. But it's actually something very important about going gradually. And some people hold on to the silence and want to keep it and want to keep going deep. Some people can't wait for something different to happen. And there's a long tradition in Buddhism that a lot of the value and the wisdom and the freedom that can come from doing this kind of practice is not from going down deep, so-called, if you like that metaphor. Or if you prefer high, not by going high, or far, or we have all these metaphors we use. I like deep, real deep. And you're going in deep. It's not about going in deep, but it's the coming out of the depth and returning to an usual way of life that there's an incomparable opportunity to see how we reappropriate, how we reconstruct, how we our ideas of ourselves and others and what we think is important and our thoughts come back. And many people don't take advantage of this period because they think, well, once their mind gets busy or start thinking more about leaving, well, the retreat's over. You know, and they just kind of, some people just blow it off, you know, well, I guess I'll just pretend until the end, but it's really over. But there's a real opportunity, very important opportunity to your mind will start thinking more, your energies will start changing somewhat. But rather than seeing this as a mistake or the end of the retreat, you might actually want to think about it as the beginning of the retreat. And all the rest was preparation. And the real retreat is actually relatively short. It's about, you know, now from now I guess it's about 16 hours really, the retreat. But it had a very long preparation time. It's that important what's happening here. So we have this more energized situation here and talking, and then we go back in silence. In the morning there'll be time for cleaning your room, which is a little different. We go back into silence. There's time to clean the center, and then we do the closing circle. And so there's a lot of opportunities going back and forth. So hopefully you'll find that it serves you. And we've been doing this at IRC, and I think we find it works overall fairly well for people. So in terms of the theme of the retreat, the idea of benefiting oneself, benefiting others, and benefits itself and others, that there's a time for each of those three categories. Sometimes it's really appropriate to focus on oneself. Sometimes it's really appropriate to focus on others. And but the one I think that most people don't maybe really understand well is caring for self and others, the we. But all three are important, and they all work together as symbiotically or in synergy or something together. And over time, I think we tune in and practice with all three, or we live in harmony with all three, hopefully. One of the great spiritual questions that some traditions uphold, some people uphold it as the question, is who am I? Or if someone asks you, who are you? And some people, well, that's their primary question. They just ask themselves that question over and over and over again. Who am I? Who am I? And I think the idea in this practice of who am I practice is to realize that the answers you come up with don't really hold water, don't really kind of work as a lasting, real, true definition of who we are. And that the people who do this as a regular practice find sometimes that their mind starts to expand. They start feeling more spacious because they stop being defined or limited by the usual concepts, ideas, biases, prejudices we have about who we are, who I am. And there's a freeing up of these definitions, and to a point where there's no answer. There's no definition. There's no answer to that question. That's the answer, kind of. And people can feel quite happy and free and liberated in a certain way by asking, like, who am I? Who am I? Just, oh, not that, not that, not that, not that. Wow, it's like gotten to be a big world here suddenly. You know, so something like that. I'm sure there's many ways in which people, as a spiritual path, take this question and go deeper. And I know of one, not a Buddhist tradition, but one kind of more modern, kind of New Age tradition, where they sit in dyads, and one person's job is to ask the question, who are you? And you answer, but who are you? They answer, but who are you? And it's kind of this digging and finding and unraveling and opening up. So it's a interesting process. But then, what if you ask that of someone else? Who are you? But don't have them answer. Maybe you do it privately. Like I look at Ruth and I think to myself, who are you? Who are you? Who are you really? Who are you? And it's just like, for me, I just fall in love with her more every time I ask the question. Wow, I don't know who Ruth is at all. And in that not knowing, wow. I mean, that's like for me, I don't know what it's like for her not to be known, but for me it's okay, right? But, you know, in the not knowing, it's like the person can be who they are. And what if, you know, Ruth had been sitting here and doing this, you know, enlightenment question, who am I, who am I? And she doesn't know, and this, I don't know, and I don't know. And she's like, becomes bigger and bigger and more spacious and free, and like, great. And then I come along and say, who are you? And then she doesn't answer. So, who are you really? And then, you know, it's like this two meeting of like not knowing. And it can be pretty special. Ryokan, a Zen priest, Zen monk, he wrote a kind of love letter to a young nun who was somehow in the neighborhood, and they struck up a friendship. We don't know what kind of friendship it was, but they had this wonderful exchange of poetry, poems back and forth. And the one poem goes something like, with no mind, meaning a mind that's luminously, beautifully empty of definition, concepts, just kind of with no mind, the butterfly finds the flower. With no mind, the flower finds the butterfly. With no mind, and he's talking to his friend, with no mind, we naturally find our way. That was a love poem. With no mind, so there's not knowing, you know, it's kind of being, I don't know, but then somehow something knows, something responds, something opens up. So what if we did that to others? Who are you? I mean, do it privately, silently maybe, but I don't know if you scare them. But it's a profound thing. Who are you? Who is the person you're sitting opposite with? Who is the person that you have known for 10 years? Who are these? And you're going to define them this way? You're going to limit them to that? You're some idea? And a very interesting moment for me was when I was maybe mid-20s, and I was practicing Zen, and I went and had a conversation with my Zen teacher, and it was kind of cozy. We met in this kind of, it was evening, nighttime, in this little, it wasn't too little room, but it was like this, kind of like imagine a nice, pristine Zen Japanese kind of room, and we were sitting like this opposite each other, and I think there was like kerosene lights burning, and so it was kind of like, you know, kind of nice, I don't know. And that was I came along and I started talking about some challenges I had with, I guess, my father or something. And I don't remember what I talked about, but I remember what he responded. He said to me, you know, your father was someone before he was a father. And your father has a life beyond being a father. And, you know, and I said, really? Really? And it was kind of my father suddenly became like more kind of fuller person, a more complex person. I kind of saw him through different eyes and in a bigger way. So who are you? You know, so who is the person you're with? Can you ask that question in a way that opens, that liberates everyone, liberates you, liberates them? We live in a society where people have answers. Who are you? You're unacceptable. You're somehow not right. You don't belong here. You're this, you're that. And we create a tremendous amount of suffering for each other by deciding we know who someone is. And it's nice to make them tell us who they are. But maybe there's something, in addition to that, something, a whole other thing. Ask, who are you? And just, no, not that, not that. I don't know who you are. And then what happens? What opens? What connection? With no mind, the butterfly finds the flower. With no mind, the flower finds the butterfly. That's a love poem. Can you believe it? What is it about that free mind, kind of empty mind, mind that's kind of full of possibilities? So this profound question of who am I, I believe it's just as profound to turn the question around. And if you really try to understand someone or be with someone, see someone, I think it just opens. They get luminous. They get beautiful. They get, how could you not love them in not knowing? They get to be who they are. So that's good. But then there's one more step. Who are we? Self and other together. Who are we? Who have we been these days here? Who are we? What are we? Who are we? Who are we as a community? Who are we as a collective? Can we ask that question the same way? We're meditators. I mean, if I answered that and then we went home, I don't think we're going to be much better because of it. We were people who were silent for, you know, a few days. Great. That's nice. But what about, well, I don't know who we are. What if we're bigger, larger, freer, more filled with possibilities, more filled with discovery than any definition that we can put on we? What if that same kind of openness of I don't know, is it possible? What happens then? So one of the profound aspects of what happened to me as I practiced, that I feel, you know, really changed me as a person from who I used to be, is this discovery that when I am free, when I don't come with my definitions, if I'm just present in an open way, just here in a full way, something like that, that I don't know. Something inside of me that is not me, that I don't understand, I can't take ownership from, I can't, will respond to the world. It's not, you know, my intention sometimes, it's not my, I don't know if I want to say choice, but there's this profound, that what feels most intimate, most profound, most true, is a responsiveness to the world that I can't take ownership from, that I can't say this is me. And one of the characteristics of this that is a response to the suffering of the world, a response to the kind of the context I'm in, a response to the situation. And so rather than being self-centered, I think of my life as become situation-centered. And it just happens coincidentally that the center of the situation happens to be over here right now, for me, this person. So, you know, kind of radiates out from here. So this context of sitting in this body, in this heart, is included as part of the situation. It's like always kind of comes along somehow. But it's not self-centered, it's situation-centered. And this idea of we just seems so natural, it seems more true than me. And it seems that it's not exactly a choice to be responsive to the world in many ways. It's just what the system wants to do. And it feels very free. And it seems to operate the best in a way that seems to have the most integrity or intimacy or ease to it or most wisdom to it, the most love in it, if I stay at ease. If I don't get caught, if I don't get anxious, if I don't get involved in definitions, I'm this way and people should see me this way, or you're that way, and let me tell you who you are, or something. You have to be this way. But this kind of just, this not knowing and here. And that is a beautiful thing. So this idea of being concerned with the benefit of self, benefit of other, and benefit self and other, doesn't have to be, at some point, as the practice kind of opens and develops, is not something that you have to do. It's what the heart does. It's what something inside, how it responds to the world. And this seems to be what the Buddha had in mind, because you see in the teachings of the Buddha an expectation that if people are awake, present, free, and without clinging, that they will care for the world. They will respond to the world. They will care for the we. They will care for themselves. They will care for the other. That's kind of just, that's part of the responsiveness that's so deeply embedded in the human heart. We are so deeply, deeply social beings. And so it kind of seems like it's just maybe built into our biology, the capacity to not for fight or flight, which is also in us, that capacity, but also we have the capacity for approach and soothe, approach and nurture. But what are the conditions that allows that to happen? And I think the profound kind of inner freedom of letting go of certainly selfishness, letting go of a certain way of letting go of definitions and ideas, a certain kind of way of not knowing and being here. And I hope that that becomes a field of love and care and mutual respect, and that in doing that, everyone gets to be themselves. No one's going to say you can't be who you are. And because no one's going to say you can't be who you are, you don't have to try. You don't have to prove yourself to anyone or defend yourself. Or you get to just be who you are. And we can just, you know, I think that the final thing to say is that as Ruth began the retreat saying, you know, you belong to me and I belong to you, and if you weren't here, I wouldn't be here. Something like that, Ruth? That a corollary of all this is that we can't really know who we are unless we know the other. We don't really know who we are in isolation. It's really in a very important way we discover ourselves in relationship. Which maybe seems a little odd to say at the end of this silent retreat where no one was being too actively relating. But I think it can be a profound way of being together and relating this kind of environment. So I hope that you felt nourished and felt connected to each other in this kind of environment, and felt that hopefully it was a little different and in a good way, special way. I hope the teachings had some relevance for you in your life. So we have a few minutes that if any of you have any questions you'd like to ask, just don't ask us who we are. Yes, please, Chewy. And we should use the mic because not everyone can hear. And
about just being ourselves and not feeling the need to prove or anything like that.
Any what?
Just about being yourself. For me, for some other people, it's not safe.
That's right.
To be ourselves.
Yes, it's true.
So where's the... I'm not asking how you figure that out, but how... How do you do you in a way that lets you keep going? Mm. I mean, how do you not betray yourself even when you have to shut down or dial it back?
Yeah.
In a very, you know, real kind of way.
Yes, absolutely. You know, it's a fluid thing, this whole definition of self and who we are and how when we establish it and assert it, when we can let go of it. And I think everyone, there are times where we have to assert ourselves, even if we don't think this is what I want to do, but what's being done to me is so terrible that I have to kind of stand here and stand my ground, or I have to protect myself, or I have to really be clear who I am in a way, because society is doing awful things to me. So there's a time and place for definition. There's a time and place for limits and clear sense of who we are. And for many people, when they first come to Buddhist practice, a lot of it is not so much a matter of discovering who they're not, it's discover who they are. And that becomes very freeing. It's very freeing to know who you are in some deep way if a person doesn't know. And it's very freeing to then know you're not that either. So it's a whole process. And so what I said this evening was not meant to say this is the final story, or this is the only approach. It's much more complicated the way we are together and what we have to do. But hopefully there's a range, and to be able to be fluid and know that in some situations we can live without definition. In some situations we have to be defined and do it in a strong, assertive way. In other situations, we know that we have to kind of take into account other people's definition of us. We have to take it into account or it's not safe for us, and we have to get out of there or do something. So knowing how to be wise with all this and the whole self thing and the fluidity of it and the need to be creative with it, I think is kind of built into this human condition. Do you want to say something? It's such an important question.
Yeah, I know. For me in this practice, it as a black woman, lesbian, coming into dominant culture of whiteness for the most part, and being a teacher and finding my voice, it's been necessary to have a strong sense of self, and even feel the shape of that, and trust what is true on the inside for me, because that's just what it's like being in a marginalized place. I don't know if you know your experience, but I think it's important to have a strong sense of self when, for me, as a marginalized person in this culture, in this community, and oftentimes in other places that I walk in. It's not the, I don't see it as a limitation to feel into the shape of the identity, given whichever one I need to kind of assert. I think that's what's being said. And it's part of the ultimate and relative dance. The cha-cha, almost, you know you're not the definition, but also you know that you are. There's some relative reality of walking around, and I think that's a particular walk in this field that we're doing, and there's no answer to how it happens, but I want to acknowledge that the walk is different. And the heart is very involved. And we don't give our egos up or our sense of self just because we hear a Buddhist teaching. You know, we have to find the direct truth for ourselves in that blossoming. And I can say for myself that the need to hold tight to any identity I have has loosened over the years through this practice. It's been less necessary to be so, attached to it. And that's been a real, often surprising experience of freedom. And I think it's one of the gifts of the practice, surprising gifts of the practice that comes in bleeps. That's has a cumulative impact over time. So it's a beautiful question you ask, and I think it's an important question to ask out loud. Thank you.
Thank you both.
I have a question for Ruth. I really appreciated your talk earlier, and especially the all the references, authors that you brought in is very kind of inspiring to me. But I have a question about something you said, which was, may I not have preferences or prejudices? Mm-hmm. And I can see the virtue in not having prejudices. Mm. I don't do it very well, I don't think, but I can hold that. But preferences kind of threw me for a loop, because I think I have preferences all through the day. I'd rather have an apple that doesn't have a bruise. I would rather have the blue sky than the gray sky. I'd rather have my son wear headphones when he's listening to music that I find unpleasant. And so I am wondering if having preferences is a cause of suffering, and because I can think of clinging as something that, oh, I'm not going to do that, that's holding on to something really mm-hmm. tightly, but mm-hmm. preferences I have more trouble with.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I can see that. I'm certainly not preference-free myself. But I think it could be an interesting experiment to see what it's like to park them. Just as an experiment to see what's there in the absence of them. So it's an offer to play with it. See what's there. That's what I do sometimes, and I've found it surprising to see to see that there is clinging in there sometimes, or there is aversion in there sometimes, and to see what I'm left with in the absence of preferences. That's what I would encourage.
Thank you.
So I was very inspired by the by your talk, but I'm specifically clinging to the story where you were in the airplane. Mm-hmm. So on one hand, my takeaway is okay. I rather decide to push my own button than to be pushed mm-hmm. Through somebody else. On the other hand, I think this guy, in a way, was rewarded. I mean, he mm-hmm. was really disrespectful, mm-hmm. and he could get as much or as little space. And so I'm thinking, how? I mean, of course, we can't change other people, but if we give in. Constantly, I think it's also not okay.
Yeah, no, it's so true. It's one of those choices. Somebody like me, I'm in the face of this often. So it is a choice around how I use my energy. It's also a trust of just rewards. I mean, you know, I don't have to be the one that teaches him the lesson. And I think this is an important sitting in your seat practice, at least it is for me. He was disrespectful. I didn't have to feel like I was disrespected, you know? I mean, so that's kind of a line I'm looking at around how I use my energy. I was pissed, make no mistake. But this happens often. So this is my you know, I was appropriately pissed, you might even say. There's been many times when the response was so not that, but it's a choice. I'm being more choiceful around how I do that. And you know, I didn't paint the full of the story, but just this choice that we have to not be a victim, to decide for ourselves what's gonna not just be in my self-interest, but what, you know, I can be dead right, you know. Sometimes we can be dead right in our insistence on things. And so, yeah, it was one of those women. He softened over the course of the flight. It was a long flight, you know, from South Africa to California. And, you know, there was a certain harmony that came into play that was more important to me than whether my chair was back. What is it, 4 inches that it goes? I mean, so I had to kind of look at the whole texture of it. And I was hurt by it. I was hurt by it. But he couldn't take care of that. You know, he couldn't take care of that hurt. I wasn't putting that in his hands. So there was some time where I sat with that and just took care of myself, you know. And I felt the whole system taking care of it too, in their own way. This is a certain attunement we get through the practice. There's a sensitivity for the whole network. And I think it's important that we tune into that. Not acquiesce and, you know, be a doormat, but to really be choiceful around where we use our energy. For me, as a group identity in so many marginalized areas, I could burn out confronting these kind of issues. I don't choose to do that. So this is one of those times. Yeah.
So I have a question related to going from having concern for ourselves to having concern for self and others. I feel that, you know, being in this community for a while and hearing this teaching, I get it. However, I don't feel that I get it at a level where I'm trying to explain it to other people and they don't get it. And I would like to be able to get to a point where I can explain it to other people that are not in this community. And I'm wondering if you can offer any advice. It's a tough question.
Yeah, I have to think about it. If you have an answer, I have to think about it for a moment, but if you have an answer.
I don't know if I'm clear on the question. Explain what to what? Self and others to other?
Yeah, no, so like, when I'm listening to all the talks, like, you know, the theme that we had a couple of days, it's very fluid. You know, like everything you say makes complete sense, both of you. Mm-hmm. And yeah, if I'm going to take care of myself, it's normal that I'm going to be taking care of others as well because we're interconnected. But I'm very interested in this topic and I try to explain that to other people and I struggle because when you get out of this community, people are not thinking like this.
I see, yeah. Some questions that we have are meant to apprentice us. They're not to be meant to be answered so much. So sometimes just sitting with not knowing how to explain it to someone is probably the best medicine. To just sit with it and let that ripen and let that come into its own sense of clarity. Yeah, sometimes it's just not ready to be voiced.
I've been working on this for a year and a half.
Yeah, you know, it could be one of those life teachers of, you know, just wanting to be your teacher before it becomes a lesson for someone else. So I would encourage a real, you know, care and ease around allowing the knowing to reveal itself instead of any effort that mm-hmm. can go around trying to get it. Mm-hmm. There's a grasping in it that I think could be working against the ease of communicating it.
I like this. I'm satisfied with this answer. I guess it makes me think of, I don't know, I call this a quote or something that a friend had told me. I don't know if it's someone famous or if it was just his PhD thesis, but it was, what is this river through which the Ganges was flowing? Mm. And it's a lot of what you've been talking about in like a knowing. It's like what you and Gil were talking about tonight, mm-hmm. not knowing. Like, yeah. You know, we just think, oh, that's the Ganges. No, that's not the Ganges. That's a river through which the Ganges is flowing.
Yeah. Yeah.
That's beautiful.
Beautiful. Thank you.
Yeah. Maybe we can do one more.
There was Kirsten. A hand.
I don't really have a question. It's more of a remark, I guess. Or a
is it on?
Yeah, put it up to you. Try.
I don't have a question as such. It's just a thought, passing thought that came through as I was listening to everybody here. And
it's hard to hear you. Your mouth, like
okay.
There we go.
Okay. So the thought that runs through me is that there's an idea of a social contract when we're thinking in terms of we or a community. There are some rules that we all accept, and if in a plane there are a set of rules, in other systems, in organized systems, there are a certain set of rules. Like we take care of our children as a community, we send them to good schools, we provide good health care to everybody, including all the vulnerable people. And sometimes we have to enforce that social contact through mutually agreed upon rules, and then we say that these rules have to be followed. And we seem to be doing such a bad job of that in lots of ways.
Yes, true. Yeah.
How do we get to that part too while taking care of we? And then she asked the question of having trouble communicating that we to others. It's lots of times the problem is they're refusing to some extent recognize this common ground, right? This common social contract that we're all part of. If the other person doesn't recognize that such a thing exists, then it's very difficult to even talk about the social contract, our common collective good. If the other person thinks that, or it doesn't have to be a person, it could be a system, organized system, or anything. If the working assumption is that I can do what I want and take care of my needs, have my own little house, my little gated community, I'll be just fine, I don't need anybody else.
Yeah.
There's a working assumption, it doesn't have to be a person. Yeah. I don't know, it's a thought that I get to know.
Yeah.
Any reflections, I would be very happy.
Yeah, it's a real statement of our times. I think Gil is the first perfect person to answer that question.
Under the bus.
But not run over yet.
Are you the driver? let's see. I don't know.
You're doing great.
Oh, did I finish? the idea of a social contract, we live in it. It's completely pervasive in order for us to get along. In this country, we agreed to drive on the right side of the road. And the fact that most of us agree to do that makes it easier for everyone else. If we take care of everyone else by driving on the right side with them, then they take care of us. And so we have this, we don't think about it so much, it's kind of so embedded in what we do until someone drives down the wrong way. And so it seems that it's a pretty natural thing to try to take care of our society by saying, you can't do that. And in fact, we have to remind you, and we're going to give you a big ticket because we need to remind you and try to protect us. It seems pretty natural to do that. And I think there's all these levels and all these ways it happens. So I don't really know how to answer your question very well, but I'll try one thing. And that is that Ruth made reference to, this relative and ultimate levels of truth or perspectives that we can have. My experience is that our minds have many levels or many dimensions. Maybe dimensions is a better word. And that we can exist in multiple dimensions at the same time. And at least that's what I've learned through this practice. So it was a time where I would have just lived in the dimension of the rules that we have and the definitions we have and the social contract, and that's how I would have seen the world and found my way around. But now I know there's more dimensions than that. And there's a dimension of not knowing, and simultaneous is a dimension of knowing I should drive on the right side of the road. And I can kind of hold those two together, and so I can keep my freedom, my ease. So I think there's a way of holding definitions, holding social contracts, holding being assertive, making, you know, insisting it has to be a certain ways, or being engaged in some strong way in the world, to be in conflict even. There's a way of doing it where there's a sense of freedom in the middle of it. There's another dimension of freedom, the dimension of not knowing, of openness, simultaneous as knowing this requires this kind of response, and this is what I should drive on the right side of the road, or, you know, something like that. So I found it helpful for me to understand these multiple dimensions operating at the same time, and there, then it becomes easier to live in the social contract side. And actually, sometimes I can be much more brave and stronger about doing that because there's other side supports that.
I just want to say a couple more things because there's so many social contracts, and we all haven't agreed to agreed with them. And I do think there's an aspect of our practice where we should consider what sets our heart on fire, and have that fire line up with how we walk in the world, so that it becomes a way that we're making choices in the face of these different contracts that maybe we're not in agreement with, maybe systems that we're not in agreement with that we want to change, or that we want to organize to confront because maybe they're systems of harm, or, you know, it's against our precepts or whatever that might be. It takes a certain fire in the belly, I think, sometimes to kind of wake up to that and align to that, attune to that, and have boundaries around that, and to be in places of resistance to systems of harm or resistance to things that are violative to the whole. Especially in this country where, you know, it was built on a sense of imbalance and built on, you know, where some folks have it and some don't, and that's how it all works. And when we're in systems like that and we're, you know, we're being affected by it, everybody's really being affected by it, they just don't know it. But how you stand in that is really kind of a fundamental question for so many people. So many people are really questioning these so-called contracts and how they do that and the support they find around that and how they align themselves so that they're not feeling isolated in it. It's just a real important spiritual practice. And to keep the heart engaged in it the entire time. So, yeah.
And there's probably no end to it.
Oh. Yeah.
So, thank you for this, and I appreciated very much this discussion, these questions, because I want this practice that we do here to address these issues, to be part of the society in these kinds of ways. I see this as kind of practice as kind of the ground for opening people up, understanding themselves, understanding their hearts, and becoming brave enough to be able to enter into the world to make a difference and make this world a better place for everyone in our society. The idea of we and the what's good for we and what's good for the others really kind of, I count on the fact that if we really tune into that, know that, then we're concerned about these issues. And we become people who want to make a difference whenever we see harm, whenever we see someone, you know. And I certainly don't want to end up creating a generation of Buddhist practitioners who learn to just radically accept the status quo. That would be tragic. I once was interviewed many, many years ago, 20 years ago, for a radio station in San Jose. And they wanted to say, they asked the question to me, what does this Buddhism have to offer this corporate culture in Silicon Valley? I paused. And he said, well, you have to understand, I said, that in its essence, Buddhism is subversive. I don't think that's what she was looking for as an answer. So please go out there and be subversive in all your freedom and compassion, weeness, and, you know, against any of the structures that we have that's causing harm. So I want to thank you all for being here. I thank you. I have tremendous respect for what you've done these days. In some ways, you know, I've devoted my life to support people to do exactly what you did, and it's quite gratifying for me to have you arrive and engage in this sincere way in which you engaged, and I think it's a wonderful thing. I think it's very profound for our society and for ourselves. And one of the things that helps me kind of feel supported, feel nourished, feel inspired, is the gratitude that I feel for people like you who come to IRC and practice. And the idea that this is a field of goodwill, hopefully, in a field of generosity, in a field of gratitude. It's kind of like built into how I would like to live my life, and I feel very fortunate that this little corner of the universe has this. And as I said, maybe the first day, I really hope that it becomes contagious. I hope that it spreads out from here and, you know, spreads out into the world, that the spirit of generosity that supports IRC, with all of you volunteering your times to help make it work, and many circles of volunteers beyond us who's making it possible, and people have offered funds to make it work, and that this generosity doesn't just stay here, but we spread it out, and you go into your communities and to your wider life, that you're inspired by this possibility of generosity and goodwill, love, and people can start feeling a greater sense of gratitude with each other. Appreciation of each other, not scared of each other. So I just want to thank you very, very much for being here, and it's a wonderful thing. Thank you. So, Kim? Or is
Okay, so I have a few announcements to help us begin the gradual transition toward returning to daily life. And we want to do that in a mindful and unhurried manner between now and tomorrow. So in general, you can trust the schedule. As it's gone up to now, we'll keep revealing things as they're needed. Everything will go smoothly. So tomorrow, the morning will begin in the same way, including Sangha service. And if you have a morning work meditation after breakfast, you'll be doing that as normal also. In the morning, we will also have two cleaning periods, one for your room and one for the center. There will be time scheduled tomorrow to pack and clean your room, but if you do have time after breakfast, feel free to start. But if you have one of those after breakfast jobs, don't worry, there's time scheduled. To clean your room, please follow the green instruction sheet that's in your room. It tells you what to do and where all the cleaning supplies are located. Are there any questions at this point? Okay, good. So the donation envelopes can now be found on top of the Donna box, which is in between the office and meeting room 1 down in the community hall. You can place a check, cash, or credit card info in them and direct your donation to the teachers, the center, or both. The instructions are on the envelopes, and then you drop them into the slot in the Donna box. If you need to print a boarding pass, I said this earlier, but in case you haven't done it yet, you can leave a note for us and check the board for a response. And then as far as rides, my understanding from check-in is that we didn't get any ride forms, but I did just want to check Mitsuko and are you guys set, Steve? You guys are set. Okay. Okay, so Arden, you could go to San Jose Airport. Okay, great. Okay. Tomorrow morning. Yeah. Does anybody else need a ride anywhere? You guys are set? Okay. Anybody else? Okay. Great. Please turn in your IRC sheets and towels if you used ones from the center. If you could turn those in as early as possible tomorrow, maybe even before the first sit, that would be great. Also, please turn in your bath mat, but do not turn in your blanket or your pillow protector. And to turn them in, there will be laundry baskets placed on each floor around the end of this evening. So that's it. Are there any questions at this point?